Muharrem'e misal.
This year, we are marking Muharram rituals under the rule of the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. However, our processions are more crowded, passionate, and prosperous than previous ones. You know that Muharram is not only related to Shias, so we have our Sunni brothers taking part in ceremonies and services shoulder to shoulder with Shias.
We Afghan girls share the grief of Karbala tragedies with Zainab, Imam Ali's daughter. We are all sorrowful on this day and remember the suffering and bravery of our role model, Hazrat Zainab. Today, we live under the flag and our hijab shows that we are her firm followers.
On Ashura, Afghan Muslims shut their businesses and take a day off to pay tribute to Karbala martyrs. They say prayers and hold charity events. This year, despite security threats, they took part in mass mourning ceremonies alongside Taliban officials.
Today is the martyrdom anniversary of great and respected Islamic figure and grandson of the Prophet Muhammad. I offer my condolences to you and all Muslims. Undoubtedly, Imam Hussein sacrificed his life to save Islam. We, the people of Afghanistan, followed Imam Hussein's path through fighting against invasion, arrogance, and oppression. May Allah keep the love of Imam Hussein alive in the hearts of all of us.
Ashura is significantly important in Islamic calendar. Ashura and Imam Hussein's school of thought teaches freedom, bravery, resistance, and Islamic unity. This righteous path will last until doomsday. We Muslims globally are obliged to announce and spread the message of Ashura to all Muslim and non-Muslim people, especially youths.
The commemoration comes as Shia Afghans have been repeatedly targeted in places of worship and schools by terrorist groups, only because of their ethnicity and beliefs. On the 7th and 8th of Muharram this year, two bomb explosions killed and injured more than 30 Shia mourners. Afghanistan has witnessed different social and political changes over the course of centuries. Against the odds, Shia Muslims have been steadfast in remembering the Battle of Karbala and Imam Hussein's martyrdom. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Hundreds of mourners marched through various streets wearing black and reciting elegies in honor of Imam Hussein, who, along with dozens of his household members and loyal companions, were martyred in Karbala in present-day Iraq.
The marchers here said this is a time for sorrow and self-reflection when one commits himself completely to the mourning. They said the mourning and the reflection of the tragic events at Karbala are intended to connect to the suffering and martyrdom of Imam Hussein.
This very day, marked 10th of Muharram, is the day of sadness, is the day of agony, is the day of shedding tears to all Muslims. And the reason is that in the field of Karbala, Imam Hussein was being mercilessly killed by Umayyad leaders.
The mourners also engaged in chest beating as the procession moved around the town in the hot tropical sun. The mourners said Ashura not only signifies intense grief for Imam Hussein, but is also a motivation for resistance against injustice in the world.
Imam Hussein has submitted his life entirely in order to save Islam. And that is what Malik Ibrahim Zakzaki Hafizahullah is calling for. That the entire Muslim and even non-Muslim, even Christian, let us gather together to fight oppressors, let humanity and then justice be in our nation.
Many of the mourners said they will continue this struggle to resist injustice because, as the well-known phrase goes, every day is Ashura and every land is Karbala. Danjum Abdullahi, Suleja.
Throngs of Londoners marching through the center of the British capital to commemorate Imam Hussein, the grandson of Prophet Muhammad, brutally murdered in the Battle of Karbala 1400 years ago. Similar processions in the rest of the UK and the world to mourn him and his 72 companions killed along with him, among them members of his family. Their crime, standing up to the tyrant of the time, the Caliph Yazid.
It was a tragic incident that happened many years ago, but the moral stand that Imam Hussein took has transcended time and space. Its reverberations felt through generations, and this is proof of it.
Many generations later, men, women, and children flagellate themselves to identify with the suffering of the Prophet's grandson, a man of morals who strived for social justice.
Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam represents all of the martyrs in all the world throughout human history and planetary geography.
For me, he represents justice, bravery, and sacrifice.
His story is an example to mankind. As he stood against oppression and injustices.
And it's not just the mourning that unites the people here. For them, the march is an annual chance to share the legacy of Imam Hussein beyond the borders of their countries of origin. Saeed Purza, London.
Mourners in Karachi commemorated the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein's youngest child, who was not spared by the enemy forces.
The 6-month-old Ali Asghar, the youngest son of Imam Hussein, was martyred by the forces of Yazid. The Battle of Karbala and Imam Hussein's sacrifices for righteousness and freedom are still a source of inspiration for Muslims around the world.
Mothers who brought their babies along paid tribute to Ali Asghar on the first Friday of the Islamic month of Muharram and mourned the 6-month-old son of Imam Hussein.
What had the 6-month-old done? We are out on the streets recalling the message of that innocent child of Imam Hussein, that we will always stand against the tyrant of the time. We will always stand shoulder to shoulder with the oppressed, no matter what.
Special eulogies and rituals were performed to commemorate the incident where Ali Asghar was killed with an arrow shot in his throat in the plains of the Iraqi city of Karbala.
We are commemorating the martyrdom anniversary of Ali Asghar, the youngest martyr of Karbala, who teaches us the lessons of readiness and sacrifice in the face of injustice and brutality.
Ali Asghar was martyred while he was in the arms of his father, Imam Hussein, who was pleading for water to quench the thirst of his little baby. The grandson of Prophet Muhammad and his companions sacrificed their lives but refused to pledge allegiance to the unjust Umayyad Caliph Yazid. Muhammad Turi, Karachi.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The stark warning from the Bank of England on the UK's economy. Not only will the UK economy face a contraction, we'll enter a year-long recession. This has forced the bank to raise interest rates to record high, which has not been done in 27 years. How will the Brits deal with this, which includes a high cost of living? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at what the UK government can do to deal with this economic challenge. This is while there's really no government in place in order to tackle this head-on. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight first. Historian and journalist Tony Gosselin joins us from Bristol. Also joining us, economist and author Steve Keen, who joins us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Steve Keen, let me first start with you and get an idea about this warning from the Bank of England. It's not obviously, it's pretty bad in its content. A recession to last until next year, which you can tell us the definition would be five consecutive quarters of a contraction, each quarter to be 3 months in duration. Tell us more about that and how the Bank of England can be so sure into the future that the UK is going to be experiencing this inflation or recession.
They can be fairly sure about the inflation as for the level of contraction. Did you say five quarters then?
Is it
five quarters of negative growth?
Is that okay. Isn't that what it is until next year?
That's the length of time. The usual, like the informal definition of a recession is two consecutive negative quarters. To get five is a serious recession. So I think it's quite feasible that these sorts of falls are going to occur because we've had two major forces that kept the economy ticking during COVID. One was enormous government deficits, which generate an identical private sector surplus, giving people money to spend, which they did, which is why the recession was so short-lived. Now the government's talking about trying to balance its books, which is a stupid thing for the government to be focusing upon, but if they do reduce their size of the deficit, they also reduce the amount of money they're injecting into private bank accounts. People have less money and there's a downturn there. And then with higher interest rates, which are now passing through to mortgages, credit cards and so on, that higher cost of money is going to discourage people from taking out credit. So rather than credit going very strongly, as it did also during the COVID boom, we could now see credit turning negative. And that's what caused the Great Recession or the global financial crisis back in 2008. So we're going to get potentially a double whammy of a government-induced recession from high rates and from cutting back on its spending on top of a private sector, one caused by a reduction in credit.
Okay. What we are also seeing here, Tony Gosling, not to get too, I guess, technical in a sense, is that we're seeing how the household incomes are not keeping up, in a sense, with the inflation. So they don't have that purchasing power. And that is going to obviously have a dent not only on the economy, but also just in terms of the quality of life that people are going to be experiencing based on what we are looking at. And, inflation the Bank of England says it's going to peak at 13.5%. But people are having a really hard time as we speak. Tell us how this is going to pan out when it comes to just people's lives in terms of what is being now announced by the Bank of England.
Well, look, Steve Keen has just explained what's going on very, very in a very, very concise fashion there. I think what we need to understand, though, is that something really big is going on. It reminds me very much of the West's reaction, the NATO countries' reaction to the Russians going into Ukraine. Is the actual solution to this, the Bank of England increasing interest rates, seems to be almost designed to make the problem worse. There's something very perverse seems to be happening. I think we're basically at war, is an economic war taking place, and that war is between traditional, sane, sensible forms of industrial capitalism, where the government acts as a kind of mediator and the central banks act as mediators in order to ensure that there's no ability for private interests to profiteer and to get into infrastructure, where basically they just sit back and reel in as much money and start price fixing as much as they want. And this new form, well, it's newer form of capitalism, which is finance capitalism, which basically means money is your god. And you can do anything with that money. If you can bribe your way into a government office and take over a government service, you can do it. And that's the war which is going on in Britain at the moment. And it does seem as if the finance capitalists are winning here. But Steve and I are both, you will see neither of us on British television talking about this. This is, of course, what British people and policymakers need to hear. And so that's interesting in itself that we are completely shut out of that debate. I have to thank you at Press TV for even allowing this to take place, that the British people can then start to see. Anyway, beyond that, you asked me about what the British people are going to be doing over this. And I've been talking to rail workers today who are having a particularly hard time and having a little chat to them, it's quite obvious to me that what's going on is... I've lost your connection completely. Sorry.
No problem. While you fix that, let me come to you, Steve Keen. This fall in living standards is said to be the longest and deepest fall on record, and it's the way it was described, that one of the biggest reasons for that are the energy bills that are set to triple. Triple. I mean, that's a lot. How does that translate for households that can't afford to, for example, pay it? You know what I mean? What was going to happen?
Yeah. Well, there are people who are already were very close to the red line in the UK. The low-income earners in the UK, I don't know how they survive, frankly. Given my own background, I was earning about £90,000 a year when I was in London, which it ended up being £4,000 a month, and half of that went in my accommodation, and the remainder had to go on living. And I found it challenging compared to the same income back in Australia, where I was quite comfortable. That I know first-year teachers, first-year nurses, first-year firemen, and so on, are on wages between £20,000 and £25,000 a year. Now, they can't even imagine living in London, and the costs for them in the rest of the country were already high. Trebling the cost of energy is going to mean for a lot of those people they will not be able to afford energy, and they will therefore have to consider things like wearing, gloves inside their own homes to avoid freezing during winter. And they certainly can't do anything to fight the increase in temperature when you get the enormous temperatures that are coming through courtesy of global warming now. England recording 40 degrees, which is literally unheard of in its historic record. So they're going to suffer very badly. And I think there's going to be an enormous amount of angst out of this and lots of strike action over it, but very little chance to change the direction of government policy and very little chance to increase their wages as well.
Well, why not? Why wouldn't the government change its policy?
The government has been following the wrong policy for 40 years. It's very unlikely to wake up, oh dear, we've been doing it wrongly, let's do it the right way now. They still think the government should be behaving like a household and trying to save money every year. Now, the government is not a household. No other household that I know of has the right to create money, but the government does. So if the government creates money, that money turns up in our bank accounts, and that requires the government to run a deficit. Now, the English government has been obsessed by running a surplus, looking at the accounting of the economy from just their point of view and thinking if they pay a surplus, they can pay their debt down and they see that as responsible. But because what happens with the government is the mirror image of what happens with the non-government, if the government runs a surplus of $1 trillion, the private sector runs a deficit of $1 trillion. We're not talking about numbers that high, but fundamentally it's a seesaw. One's up, the other's down, the average is zero. So if the government is trying to save money, it's causing the private sector to dissave. Now, they've been doing that nonetheless for 40 years. They still haven't woken up. I really have no confidence that they will ever wake up over this. So they're doing the wrong thing, and yet they're thinking doing the right thing. Humans' capacity to self-delude cannot be underestimated.
Uh-huh. So the lesson I'm learning from you here, and hopefully the viewers, is that the government shouldn't have a surplus because that money should actually be flowing into the people, average people, to take out and spend into the economy. So having a surplus is not... great idea. Okay, so the cost of living crisis, Tony Gosling, this is what the Bank of England has said, that it's going to continue throughout next year and only begin to ease in the year 2024. And then, of course, along with that, the UK economy contracting for all this time. 2024 is 2022. The timeline there is so long. How are people going to survive?
No, I know, but you see, the thing is, these predictions by the Bank of England have a rather a nasty habit of in a couple of years' time, they say, well, sorry, we got that wrong. It's going to be continuing even beyond that, this recession. I mean, I think really what we're looking at here is a deliberate sabotaging of the economy. The thing is that there are people that benefit from this. You have to understand this is how finance capitalism works. What they do is they wreck countries and then they pick up the pieces for next to nothing. And that's what they're doing to Britain now. Many of these Anglo-Zionist Empire great financiers have been doing this around the world. They've been wrecking countries and then buying up for cheap. And also, of course, they make a lot of money on these reconstruction contracts. And one of the big effects of the enormous green taxes that have been being put onto fuel here in Britain is that it's driving small firms out of business, many small firms. In Bristol, we've been checking out the tax which is being put onto people. They say it's a clean air tax, but against their own figures, of 40 micrograms of nitrogen dioxide per square meter. This is the amount that they use to measure whether it's a dangerous level or not. The Bristol figures are actually below that level as an average through the year, which is what the government has said. And yet they're imposing this new toll, effectively. That's what it is anyway. The super rich don't pay the toll because they all have brand new cars, which don't pay the toll. And even disabled people have to pay these tolls. So what we're really looking at is an embattled criminal elite, I think. And their plans are failing around the world. Their economic plans are failing. And so they're turning on their own population and seeing them now as a kind of milch cow in order to squeeze them for as much wealth as out of them as they possibly can. And when they collapse these small businesses, this of course, plays into the hands of the giants like Amazon, who I noticed, by the way, today, in Britain, we've had one of the first proper strikes at Amazon, where all of the Amazon workers who were offered 35 pence pay increases, you know, tiny amounts of money by the company, have just downed tools. And at one point, actually, they were locked up illegally within the workplace and they couldn't leave. So this is what we're dealing with. I think a fascistic system where, and I use that word advisedly because this is fascism. When big corporations think they can rule the roost, do what they want without any kind of recourse to government or law, they just see then the legal actions against them as a cost of doing business. And so they just do what they want. And that's what I think we're seeing. These big companies now think, well, the more small businesses we can ruin and destroy, the bigger our control of the markets will be. And that's, you're quite right to point out at the beginning that we're in this kind of interregnum here in Britain where Boris has gone. We've got probably a couple of people possibly taking over, most likely Liz Truss, who is a total puppet. So there is no real government. You're quite right. And the big corporations love it like that. The big oil companies, the energy companies have just brought in record profits more than ever before. They are basically running the show here, and the people are cannon fodder to them.
Okay, well, let's look at the reasons that have been cited, first of all, how this has been described, Steve Keen. High inflation, low growth, soaring energy bills. And it's been described as the main driver behind that overall is the Ukraine conflict. Now, do you agree that this is just because of the Ukraine conflict? I mean, was UK's economy doing well before the Ukraine conflict, or were there remnants prior to that?
I think there are basically three major factors that are coming together all at once. One is that we have pushed, we've ignored the warning of the limits to growth 50 years ago and continued pushing our energy consumption. So now we're consuming probably four times as much as we were back in 1972. And that means we've exhausted cheap oil. We're now exhausting even unconventional oil. So the cost of energy is rising, and that's inevitably going to continue happening. We, at the same time, we have had a period of extended low inflation courtesy of globalization. So particularly American corporations, but also UK corporations, have outsourced manufacturing to China, which reduced costs dramatically for a long, long time, but also made the manufacturing sector very fragile because there's an enormous supply chain. And if that gets disrupted at any point, then costs rise. And of course, COVID has dramatically disrupted the supply chain, particularly from China. Then we have this period of ongoing austerity by governments where they falsely believe they should save money. But rather than saving money, what they're doing is creating not enough money, and therefore the economy grows more slowly because of a lack of government of money for turnover. So those three factors are all coming together at once. And the most important one, I think, for the long term is a rising cost of production. And in that situation, if you want to squeeze inflation out of the economy, there's only two other factors you can affect. You can reduce wages, which are already at trivial levels in the UK, or you can reduce the markups that firms put on their input costs. And that is something which the firms have resisted for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. Now, the interest rates are likely to increase the cost of business, not reduce it. So I think the government is finding out how impotent it is now with the tools it's chosen to use.
The 2008 financial crisis, obviously, Tony Gosling, had a very deep effect and impact not only across the world but also on the UK. Now, this one, which has been described as a recession that's going to last, it's the longest downturn since the 2008 financial crisis. And the way that one analyst has described it is that it's going to be as deep. It's not set to be as deep as 14 years ago, but it's going to last just as long. My question is, do you agree? And do you think that, according to some, that the UK actually, did it claw itself out of the 2008 financial crisis all the way, or is it still experiencing it?
Well, look, I'm sure Steve will agree that the reaction to the 2008 bailouts, I mean, this was really where massive amounts of public money went to save zombie banks, and they shouldn't really have done. They should have just simply been allowed to collapse. But what happened there was the end of capitalism. It was the death of capitalism, because what happened, what they did is they resurrected these banks that should have just been allowed to collapse. And what that's done is it's now compounding the problem again and again. What we're seeing is governments, in fact, there was an enormous bailout during the COVID crisis, as people may know, just before the COVID crisis in 2019, which the COVID crisis was quite successfully hid. And so we're not getting the proper figures about how much public money is going into propping up these dead and dying banks. And that's, I think, what's going on. And actually, on the ground here, what we've got, of course, is we've got people's living standards being eroded in all sorts of ways, particularly through these rising energy prices, which I'm not sure, as Steve suggested there, is just part of a market force that's going on. There are enormous green taxes now coming in. We've got something in Britain called the RTFO, which went up 20 pence a litre on diesel and petrol over Christmas. But the fuel companies actually covered that up by dropping their price the same day by an equivalent amount. So there's a sneaky bringing in of these so-called green taxes into fuel. And one of the things that Boris did before he went back in 2021 was actually to refuse this new increase, these green taxes, in the cabinet, saying that, well, hang on, because this is going to cause inflation. Well, of course, it has caused inflation. But the thing is, they did it anyway. They basically ignored the what was the discussion in cabinet, and parts of the government, the Department for Transport, the Treasury, colluded with the big oil companies to bring the taxes in anyhow. So there are all sorts of reasons for this, but the main problem is that people's living standards are being eroded. That's why we're seeing industrial action on the railways, which is the biggest union in the country, who actually represent the left in Britain. They represent the political opposition to the Tory party, really, because the Labour Party is simply doing absolutely nothing about all this. And I think we're going to see more and more of that. That is to say, people simply saying, getting organised and simply saying, well, we refuse to work if you're going to be, destroying our jobs and also eroding our ability to pay. But look, the long and short of this is, in a nutshell, is this is the Great Reset. I believe that is exactly what's going on here. This is what was talked about in 2020 and 21 by the World Economic mm-hmm. Forum. What they really want to do is to collapse the economy and replace it with their own version. So this is what's called disaster capitalism. This is what Naomi Klein called disaster capitalism. But they're doing it on their own people now. They've been doing it around the world for years. Now they've turned on their own kind.
That was discussed at the WEF. Do you agree with this, Steve Keane, that this is the Great Reset?
No, I don't. I'm sorry. I've met quite a few of the people that are supposed to be running this conspiracy, and they couldn't plan lunch. Okay. The extent to which people think a conspiracy is causing all this, yes, of course, these people are conspiring. Yes, of course, they're trying to get outcomes that suit themselves. Do they understand the system they're managing? Not in the slightest. So they end up causing catastrophes. And what you get is the disaster to another, and they try to maneuver their way through. They've got more power, of course, than a worker or a member of a trade union has, so they can come out on top as a result of it. But to put this down as a result of some sort of plan, as I said, they couldn't plan lunch. So I think it's ridiculous to blame it on a conspiracy, but to correct it, blame on people being in charge of a system they don't understand, and it's being fitted by hit by forces they have ignored for 50 years, the limits to growth in particular, the wrong way to run monetary policy. Bring it all together. I could use lots of very colourful terms here to describe what's going on, but none of them involve a power elite knowing what they're doing.
Well, we need to find out, not we, the UK and the incoming administration, whoever's going to be the PM, needs to figure out what to do. Is there a game plan? Tony Gosling, 30 seconds.
Well, what they need to do, I think, is to bring most of the infrastructure of the country, including the railways, etc., into public ownership. And they can do that very easily, very cheaply, by just simply not renewing franchises. This is happening naturally anyway. For example, on the railways, we've had several of the companies that have been running regional railways collapse anyway, and right. The government's had to take them in hand themselves. But those organisations, including, by the way, I think, finance needs to be seen as a public utility, as it is in China and Russia and places like that, where the core of the financial system is managed by the government. That's why we elect them, in order to run the country.
Okay.
The worst thing in the world is when all these private businesses take these over. This was started by Thatcher, of course. We need to renationalize these things.
Very well. Thank you for that. Tony Gosling from Bristol, historian and journalist. Steve Keen from London. Thank you, economist and author. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Batahwe and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, that was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. As you know, we have taken up explanation of Surah Hadid, which is number 57 in the serial order of compilation of the Noble Quran, and mentions the heavy metallic element called hadid, or iron, as being sent down by God to endow the earth itself with mighty force and provide humanity with the many benefits of its structural strength, as well as all the great tests of faith that arise from this. The surah presents several divine attributes, then proceeds with the grandeur of the Noble Quran, the state of believers and hypocrites on the day of resurrection, accounts of the past nations, and spending in the way of Allah for establishment of social justice. It criticizes monasticism and social seclusion, and mentions the response received from the public by the previous prophets. We continue from where we left you a fortnight ago, and here are ayahs 16 and 17.
أَلَمْ يَأْنِ لِلَّذِينَ آمَنُوا أَنْ تَخْشَعَ قُلُوبُهُمْ لِذِكْرِ اللَّهِ وَمَا نَزَلَ مِنَ الْحَقِّ وَلَا يَكُونُوا كَالَّذِينَ أُوتُوا الْكِتَابِ ولا يكونوا كالذين أوتوا الكتاب من قبل فطال عليهم الأمد فقست قلوبهم وكثير منهم فاسقون اعلموا أن الله يحيي الأرض بعد موتها قد بينا لكم الآيات لعلكم تعقلون.
Is it not time yet for those who have faith that their heart should be humbled for Allah's remembrance and to the truth which has come down and to be not like those who were given the book before, that is the Jews? Time took its toll on them, and so their hearts were hardened, and many of them are transgressors. Know that Allah revives the earth after its death. We have certainly made the signs clear for you so that you may apply reason. If you might recall, in our previous episode of this series, a couple of weeks ago, we said the light of faith will guide the faithful toward paradise on Judgment Day, while those who did not come out of darkness of ignorance, polytheism, atheism, and hypocrisy will remain in darkness in the hereafter. People are rewarded or punished according to their deeds, not acquaintance, which means a life of disbelief and sins entails the punishment of hell in the hereafter. And there won't be any ransom or rescue on Judgment Day for the disbelievers and hypocrites. The ayahs that we recited to you now are a warning to the believers against arrogance or hardening of their hearts, despite being guided by the Prophet and the teachings of the Noble Quran, which insists that the believers should always remember God and be humble towards Him. In other words, true believers should not be like the nations of the past, including Jews and Christians, who despite the revelation of heavenly scriptures, neither followed the letter and spirit of these holy texts, nor were loyal to the teachings of the prophets. It is thus crystal clear that if believers remember God Almighty from the bottom of the heart, ponder upon the Noble Quran, and heed the Prophet's explanation of its ayahs, their hearts will naturally be softened and humbled, and they will not drift away from religion and spiritual values by being immersed in worldly affairs. Ayah 17 refers to the revival of the seemingly dead earth by the Almighty Creator through rainfall in order to awaken the hearts of the believers who ought to reflect upon the signs of the world of creation and should soften their hearts through remembrance of God Almighty and recitation of the Noble Quran by contemplating on the meanings of the ayahs. A narration from Imam Musa Kazem, peace upon him, the Prophet's seventh infallible heir, says, God Almighty gives life to dead hearts through the light of wisdom, the same manner that He gives life to the earth by sending down blissful rains on it. From these ayahs, we learn that, number one,
God's remembrance softens the heart and makes believers to be humble. Number two, passage of time and long life may cause many believers to drift towards worldly pleasures and be negligent of religious values, but remembrance of God removes such danger. And number three, we should not consider ourselves to be superior to others, since divine revelations is for the guidance of all human beings and not any particular nation. Now let us listen to ayahs 18 and 19 of the same surah.
Innal musaddiqina wal musaddiqati wa aqradu Allah qardan hasanan yudha'afu lahum wa lahum ajrun kareem. والذين آمنوا بالله ورسله أولئك هم الصديقون والشهداء عند ربهم لهم أجرهم ونورهم والذين كفروا وكذبوا بآياتنا أولئك أصحاب الجحيم.
Indeed, the charitable men and charitable women and those who sent Allah a good loan, it will be multiplied for them, and there is a noble reward for them. Those who have faith in Allah and his prophets, it is they who are the truthful and the witnesses with their Lord. They will have their reward and their light, but as for those who are faithless and deny our signs, they will be the inmates of hell. Men and women are equal in achieving moral and spiritual virtues through obedience to the Prophet and expending their possessions in the way of Allah, which this ayah likens to a loan and says the rewards will be greatly multiplied out of divine grace, although whatever we possess actually belongs to the Almighty Creator. Ayah 19 makes mention of sincere believers who are always cognizant of God Almighty and the practice and behavior of the Prophet, and thus mold their life according to these dynamic values. Such people live according to truth, and they will be rewarded for their righteous deeds, and their light is the reward of their sincere belief, in contrast to those who deny divine signs and belie the prophets, and as a result will be cast into hell. These ayahs teach us that, number one, charity towards the needy is the sign of honest faith. Number two, any kind of help for the less fortunate is considered a loan to God, who will reimburse it with multiple rewards. And number three, the transient life of the mortal world is not the end, but is a passage towards the hereafter and resurrection for the Day of Judgment, on which the believers will be rewarded and the disbelievers condemned to eternal punishment. Thank you. In conclusion of this week's episode of Path Towards Enlightenment, here is Ayah 20 of Surah Hadid.
اعلموا أنما الحياة الدنيا لعب ولهو وزينة وتفاخر بينكم وتكاثر في الأموال والأولاد كمثل غيث أعجب الكفار نباته ثم يهيج فتراه مصفرا ثم يكون حطاما وفي الآخرة عذاب شديد ومغفرة من الله ورضوان وما الحياة الدنيا إلا متاع الغرور.
Know that the life of this world is just play and diversion and glitter and mutual vainglory among you and covetousness for wealth and children, like the rain whose vegetation impresses the farmer. Then it withers and you see it turn yellow. Then it becomes chaff, while in the hereafter there is a severe punishment and forgiveness from Allah and His pleasure, and the life of this world is nothing but the words of delusion. This ayah refers to various periods of human life, since love for the mundane world is the origin of all sins and the springhead of all errors. This ayah presents a telling depiction of the worldly life, its different stages, and the motives dominating each stage by pointing to the cycles of human life, which consist of neglect, amusement, luxury, boasting, and rivalry in respect of wealth and children. For instance, childhood is spent in neglect, ignorance, and amusement. Adolescence is spent in playfulness and escaping from serious issues to amusement. Youth is spent in lust, love, and luxury. Then a person reaches the next stage and is inclined toward prestige and boastfulness. Finally, the last stage of life begins when a person becomes preoccupied with gaining more possessions and having more children and grandchildren. In other words, this ayah clarifies how each period of an average life of 60 or 70 years makes the human being busy. It then goes on to draw a similitude with the life of plants, which complete their cycle of growth, flowering, fruition, and finally withering within a period of several months or some years. We should thus reflect upon this reality in order to strive towards the satisfaction of our beloved Creator and the benefits of the hereafter, rather than being deceived by our own transient life and its unending desires, which are nothing but delusion. This ayah teaches us the following points. Number one, proper cognizance of the world and its characteristics make us immune from the dangers of disbelief and sins. Number two, excessive attachment to the materialistic life of the transient world is nothing but drifting away from truth and realities of creation. Number three, life without faith in God and observance of spiritual values is just a childish play. And number four, it is true that all human beings enjoy the life of the world to varying degrees, including as gifts of God Almighty, but the real bounties are those of the hereafter, where bliss is achieved through faith and good deeds, while disbelief and sins means permanent punishment.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB.